Welcome to Central Coast Voices. Today, join Lata Murty as she speaks with guest Margaret Nakamura Cooper of Santa Maria. They'll talk about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, as Margaret herself experienced it. They will also talk about Margaret's life before and after internment, what brought her to the Central Coast, and what today's Central Coast residents can learn from the history of Japanese American internment. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX.
Thank you, Hank. A still often hidden part of American history is the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Many U.S.-born citizens of Japanese descent were suspected of being disloyal to the United States, even though many had never set foot in Japan. Here with me today to talk about her experience of internment during World War II is Margaret Nakamura Cooper, a resident of Santa Maria. Welcome, Margaret. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for asking me. I was 12 years old during World War II when I was interned, first at a racetrack at Santa Anita, California, and then later at another camp in Heart Mountain, Wyoming. I had never left my state of California before, so this was a very unique and scary experience for a 12-year-old.
I can't imagine how scary that must have been. So, Margaret, what year were you born?
I was born in 1930 in Mountain View, California.
And what was your childhood like in Mountain View?
Well, it was pretty bare, and I would say we were poor farmers. My father had come from Japan in 1916, and my mother was born in San Jose, California, actually in a place called Agnew, and she was an American citizen.
And did you have siblings growing
up? Yes, I had siblings. I had an older brother, David, who was 3 years older than myself. And I had my next brother was Kenny, and he was 18 months younger than me. And then the youngest was another boy named George, who recently died. And so that was my family. My father was a farmer, and he raised berries on Dale Avenue in Mountain View.
What brought your parents to Mountain View?
Well, actually, it was the Depression, because my mother and father were married and lived in Los Angeles. They owned a dry cleaning establishment, but in 1929, as most everyone knows, there was the Great Depression. So my father lost his business, and in desperation, they moved north to Mountain View, where my mother's father lived, or actually her stepfather lived, and they lived with him for a while. But my father needed to do something to make a living, so he did what many other Japanese people did, aliens did, and he became a farmer. He couldn't own land, however, because he was not a citizen, and he couldn't become naturalized because he was from Japan, and there was discrimination against people from Japan. So my father remained an alien.
But your mother was a citizen, correct?
My mother was a citizen and was born here. And I just recently learned, well, when I say recently, she turned 100 and she told me something I had never known before. She said that in 1921, when she married my father, who was an alien, she lost her citizenship. I said, why, that's impossible. How could you lose your citizenship when you were born in California? Well, she said, that's what happened. She said, I was a person without a country. I had never been to Japan, And I was born here, and yet I had no country. And fortunately, however, she regained her citizenship 11 years later when the League of Women Voters and other institutions helped to regain her citizenship. A lot of people don't realize that this could happen, but it did.
Wow, so 11 years later, what year was that?
Well, I think it was, 11 years after 1921 would be 32, wouldn't
1932.
It? Yeah. And I think it was something called the Cable Act that took my mother's citizenship away. I think that was the name of the act. But I've always had a soft spot in my heart for the League of Women Voters, and I became a member myself just because of that one incident.
And so each of your parents was a different generation then of
Japanese-American. Yes. My mother was 11 years younger than my father. And actually, she met him by chance, unlike most Japanese couples who were either picture brides or, had some kind of a family connection. My mother met my father by accident because her younger sister, who was walking home from school one day, was picked up by my father, who was looking for another family from Japan, because this other woman who was a schoolmate said, if you ever come to go to the United States, look me up because I'm going to go to California. So he was on his way in his new Ford car and stopped by the side of the road when he saw this little Japanese girl walking by the side of the road. He stopped his car and asked the girl if he knew where the Miyashitas lived. And this little girl says, no, I don't, but my father would know, I suppose. So he said, hop in the car and I'll drive you home, because they were only about a mile or so from her home. And so he found out where the Miyashitas lived, but in doing so, he saw an older girl picking berries and assumed that this must have been this little girl's older sister. So when he finally went and found the Miyashitas, he asked about this older girl, and the Miyashita lady said, well, that must be Nellie, the older sister of the girl that you picked up. So as it turned out, he was introduced to this 18-year-old girl, and that's how they struck up a relationship. And my mother said that she wrote to my father, who lived in L.A., and I imagine that she must have written in Romaji, which is kind of a Japanese written in Roman letters, and because my mother couldn't write Japanese characters, and my father couldn't write in English, so that's the hybrid way in which they communicated. But in any event, in a year, they got friendly enough that my father proposed, and that's how my mother and father met.
What a wonderful story. So Nellie was your mom?
Nellie was my mom, and Harry was my father. Now, of course, he was born Takazo, but when he came to this country, he wanted to become more Americanized, and since he was married to an American, he decided he wanted to assume the name of Harry. So he changed his legal name to Harry Takazo Nakamura.
So your father, Harry, was first generation Japanese-American.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And your mother
was a second generation. And she was called Anise, Ni meaning two. And my father was an Ise, Ichi meaning one. So an Ise was a person like my father who came from Japan. A Nise is a person like my mother who was born in this country, but second generation. And I was considered a Sansei. Now, San means three. Although technically, I guess I was a Nise and a half because my father was an Ise and my mother a Nise. But my mother was very, English was her first language since she went to school here, though she did speak the Japanese language since her parents came from Japan.
So what brought your grandparents on your mother's side to the United States?
My grandmother had a very unique and interesting background. When my grandmother Rui lived in Japan, she somehow knew how to speak a little English. So when Nellie Hill from Boston traveled to Japan and found Rui, who could speak English, she asked this young lady if she would become her companion and travel with her and help her out in Japan. So Rui did that, and the two single ladies traveled around together in the late 1800s. And this was quite a unique situation because women in those days didn't travel without men accompanying them. But since Nellie Hill was pretty wealthy, the two of them traveled around the world, and literally around the world, since my mother found brochures in a trunk that said Paris or London or Rome. And so the two ladies went either overland, but probably mostly by sea. And my mother said when she was a little girl, she saw a brochure that said Ceylon. Of course, that's Sri Lanka right now. But she said she saw this brochure that advertised tea. So I guess this was Ceylon tea that she saw. But anyway, she also collected pieces of fabric around the world, and mostly silk. And later on, when Miss Hill took her back to Boston with her, she took her to a sewing school, and my grandmother learned how to make crazy quilts, which was the rage in those Victorian days. So I still have that crazy quilt in my possession, even though it is getting pretty ratty looking, and silk is very delicate. But it is a historic bilingual quilt because there's embroidery written in both English and Japanese. And a quilter once told me it's probably the only bilingual quilt in existence. So anyway, I loaned it to a museum in Santa Barbara. And I like to talk about this grandmother of mine who was so unique and interesting.
That's wonderful. So what museum?
This was the Historical Museum in Santa Barbara. They had a quilting show there one time, and so I lent it to them for a while.
I'm Lotta Murty with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. With me today is Margaret Nakamura Cooper, a Japanese-American resident of Santa Maria, California. And Margaret and I are talking about her experience living in an internment camp during World War II during her adolescence. Actually, we're about to talk some more about that, but we so far have been talking about Margaret's parents and her family. So, Margaret, you were sharing your mother's very unique, really, experiences. And there's a book written about her experiences, correct?
Yes, there is. And the second edition is called My First 100 Years, because my mother lived to be 107 and a half, and this is related to that fact that she lived so long.
And if listeners are interested in reading that book, how could they get a copy?
This book, How to Get a Copy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, my brother, who financed this whole project, got several boxes of these books. And he gave me several boxes and said to me, well, give them away to your friends. But it has an ISBN number. And I said to him, why don't you have the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles sell them? But he was not interested in selling them. He said, well, just give them away. So I've been giving them away when the occasion occurred.
Very, very nice. So going back to your father, what brought him to the United States?
Well, here's another interesting story. My father's father, my grandfather, was a Shinto priest, and he was a scholar. He loved writing. He was a very good calligrapher and well known for his calligraphy. In fact, he hired himself out to write legal documents for people who were illiterate or people who had a hard time writing anything in Japanese. So he wanted his son, my father, to be a scholar also, but my father wasn't cut out for that life. And at that time in Japan, there were hard times, and I think people had a hard time getting a job, although my father got a job in a factory. It was a cotton spinning factory, and he got a job as an accountant, and he went up and down the lines where girls were spinning cotton, and he, with his abacus, found out how many hours they worked. Now, at the same time that he did this going down the line, there was another man at the other end that did the same thing. And if they came up with the same number, then that would be the number that they would use. But if they came up with a different number, they had to do the whole thing over again. So this was the days before computers, so I guess it took a little while to compute the hours of work that the girls did.
So fast forwarding to life in the United States for your parents and for you, you were born in the United States, so you hadn't been to Japan in your childhood. So how old were you when you found out that your family would have to go to an internment camp? Actually, you told us you were 12.
Yes. Well, I was actually 11, but I was almost 12, yes.
And what year was this?
1941 was when Pearl Harbor happened, and that was December 7th, 1941. And by April, I was behind barbed wire. That's how quickly I had to go in, and that's when 120,000 other people just like me had to be interned also. And not only that, most people don't realize that most of us were children, and most of us had no desire to do anything bad to the United States, because when I saluted the flag at school, I pledged allegiance to the flag of the United States, which I thought was my country, but now my government was telling me maybe I was not an American. Maybe I was on the other side.
So were those your first thoughts when you found out in April 1942 that you and your family would have to go to an internment camp? Or what were your first thoughts? What was running through your head?
My first thoughts Well, I remember thinking to myself, maybe if I ran away, they couldn't find me. But then I realized one look at my face and they'd know that I was the enemy, or that what they thought was the enemy. Anybody that looked like me must be the enemy because my face looked like the enemy. So anyone with the one drop of Japanese blood had to be considered an enemy. And of course, this was not true, but we were made to feel somehow guilty for having had this tainted blood.
Wow. So that's a lot to think about at 12. What were your other family members' thoughts? Did they share them with you?
You know, my older brother, who was 3 years older than myself, did not talk about this at all. And my mother and father barely talked about the fact that we had to go somewhere. As a matter of fact, my mother sewed me an outfit and herself an outfit, a seersucker green and white dress, mother and daughter dress, because that was sort of the style in those days. So she didn't want me to feel bad about this trip that we're going on. And so she made me not only the seersucker dress, but a corduroy jacket and pants that matched. So she was trying to make things a little bit better for me, so I could sense that she was trying to do when I tried to keep a stiff upper lip. Although one time she took me with her, she said, "We're going to say goodbye to your teacher," and I remember the teacher's name was Miss Paulus. She was my sixth grade teacher. My mother found out her home address, and we knocked on her door. Miss Paulus let us in, but she sort of stood on the other side of the room, and we sat very, I want to say nervously, on the other side of the room. And when my mother said that we were going away, Miss Paulus didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry," or "I hope you come back soon," but she just sat there stiff-lipped. And I remember how nervous I felt when we left. And my mother said, "You know, we had to do the polite thing." And even though she was not polite herself, we had to show that we were civilized people. And I'll never forget that. My mother said she doesn't remember that, but I do remember that because I was very, very nervous and upset about the whole thing.
And you still remember it. So a trip, you said that your mother made you that dress for the trip you were going to go on. So where did that trip lead you?
Well, that trip led me to this railroad station. And at the railroad station, all the Japanese people and Japanese Americans in Mountain View gathered. And there were sawhorses all around all the wide area, and all the Japanese people were enclosed in this area. There were very few people to come and say goodbye, but we were waiting there with tags on our coats. And these tags were made of cardboard, and each tag had a number on it. We did not have tattoos the way other people in Europe did, but we did have these tags that had a number on it, so we were dehumanized in a way. And even babies in orphanages had to have a number. And all of us, most of us, were American citizens, so that really hurt.
Do you still remember your number?
No, I don't remember. But I have a copy of it because one time I went to Heart Mountain, Wyoming for a reunion, and they had a book with our numbers in there, and they looked up my number and then printed out a replica of this tag that I wore as a 12-year-old and gave me a copy. So I still I have that replica.
Wow, so you're at the railroad station in Mountain View, and you get this tag, and then did the train take you directly to Santa Anita?
Yes, the train went directly to Santa Anita, and when I suddenly realized as I got off the train that I was going into a prison camp, that was the moment that I said, I am going to prison. But why did I have to go to prison? Only bad people went to prison. And that was the first time it emotionally hit me that I was being locked up. And it was a shameful experience because I had never realized that a whole group of people were going to be imprisoned, and I had no idea how long it was going to be, whether it was going to be months or years, and how many years, I did not know. And when we were moved from Santa Anita to Mahart Mountain, which took about 3 days, they told us we could not look out the windows. We had to pull down the shades, and I don't know whether it was to keep us from looking out or whether it was to keep other people from looking in. But it took 3 days to get there, and between each car there was a soldier, a soldier with a rifle, and on the end of the rifle was a bayonet. I'll never forget the look of that bayonet. And we could not go from one car to the next, so we had to stay in our car and keep the shades down. But we did have to stop at a station occasionally because I think that's when they brought food aboard. And it seemed to me that we had a cardboard box or something with a sandwich and an apple or something, but I don't remember exactly what kind of food we had. But we were there 3 days, so I know they had to give us food.
And that was the trip from Santa Anita to
Heart Mountain, Wyoming. Yeah, and Wyoming, of course, we were not prepared for the winters there, and it was a cold winter in 1942, the winter of 42 in Wyoming, and I think it was below 30 degrees below zero. It was very cold and snowy, and of course the barracks were all standard-sized barracks, and one family occupied one room. Big families were able to stay in a larger room. Small families had small rooms. There was barely enough room for a cot, and there was room to walk around a little bit, but there wasn't much. And I remember my mother saying to my brothers, now if you fight, I can't keep you from fighting, but if you fight, do it quietly because we have neighbors and there's a thin wall between our room and the next room. So my brothers used to punch each other and roll on the floor, but they didn't yell and scream.
We are going to take a short break to hear from our studio and a little bit of music.
Hi, I'm Fred Friedman. Thursday evenings, I enjoy playing music for you on Jazz Liner Notes from 10 p.m. until midnight. Or you can listen anytime on demand at kcbx.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to Central Coast Voices. I am on with Margaret Nakamura Cooper, a Japanese-American resident of Santa Maria who was interned during World War II. And Margaret and I are talking about her experiences being interned in both the Santa Anita and Heart Mountain, Wyoming internment camps. So, Margaret, you were describing the Heart Mountain, Wyoming camp. Can you describe what the Santa Anita internment camp was like?
Well, it was a huge temporary camp, and the reason they had that first temporary camp was to kind of get the permanent camps built. And there were 10 camps around the country. There was one in Arkansas, I think two in Arkansas, and of course one in Wyoming, and other places like Arizona and Utah and Colorado, I believe. But the people there were I would say there were at least 10,000 people in each camp, which seems like a lot, but when you think of the fact that these were just Japanese people of Japanese ancestry, if they were going to be equal about this and non-discriminatory and put Italian Americans and German Americans into camps also, that would be a physical impossibility. As a matter of fact, Japanese Americans in Hawaii were not interned the way we were because a great portion of the population of Hawaii was Japanese American, so that was an impossibility. So this was sort of an unfair situation, and as it turned out, there were people in California who wanted the internment because they themselves would benefit. The farmers, for instance, the Italian, the Portuguese, and some other immigrant farmers were happy to see the Japanese farmers go because that would be less competition for them, and they could take over the Japanese farms. But for every person of ill will, there was also another person who really helped their Japanese neighbors and took care of the property, paid the taxes and so forth, and waited until they came back. And so there were many cases of good people who really were very friendly towards the Japanese. And we appreciated those people who were so fair-minded.
So 1942 is when you and many others were interned until the end of World War II. It was about 3 years.
Yes, and many people were interned, and they had no place to go, so they were there, you know, 3 and 4 years. Myself, my family was there only a year and a half, a half a year in the assembly center in Santa Anita, and 1 year at Heart Mountain because my father was able to get a job at a dry cleaning establishment in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and my mother got a job in alterations at Young Quinlan Department Store. So if you could get a job and they looked into your background and decided you weren't a spy, they let us go to an intern, a city that was in the interior of the country. We couldn't go back to California, but Minneapolis, Minnesota was okay. So while I was in Minneapolis for that year, I went to Bryant Junior High School, and I must say I was well treated, and I was the only Japanese American in that school. And in fact, I think they singled me out to treat me well. And they invited me posture queen of the school, and I was to march in the Aquatennial parade that they have annually in Minneapolis. But unfortunately, even though my mother made me a white outfit, I got the flu and I couldn't march in that parade. But I must say they were very kind to me. And really, another good thing that happened, I learned to swim in the PE class there. And today I swim every day. And even though I'm 91, I do that as a form of recreation, and I owe that to the fact that I learned to swim in Minneapolis. They wouldn't let anybody graduate without being able to swim across the pool. So that was a very good thing that happened to me in Minneapolis.
That is a good thing. That started you swimming for life.
Yeah.
So going back to the internment camps, I know you've told me just how uncomfortable the camp was in Santa Anita. You've told me before.
Well, before I forget, I want to tell you that my Aunt Pauline was 9 months pregnant when she got into the camp, and she gave birth to her firstborn child at Santa Anita. And it brings to mind another baby boy that was born 2,000 years before in a stable, much like Santa Anita. And he also was not welcomed. So I think of my cousin Byron, who was born in Santa Anita camp, who later, however, became an architect and now lives in Hawaii, did very well. And as a matter of fact, many people who were interned did well, and their children did well. And one good thing that happened, even though this bad thing happened first, was that after the war, the children of these people who were so terribly discriminated against were able to become not only engineers and other professionals, but they got jobs. And so the bad things that, the occupations that they were not able to participate in before World War II now were open to them. So that part was a good thing. And very soon after World War II, a lot of war brides came back, and it was found that these people were not monsters, and they were people just like the rest of the world.
So while you were in the camps, what was provided and what was not?
Okay. While we were in the camp, in order to keep warm, they threw a pile of coal right next to the laundry room, and we ran out there with a bucket and picked up the coal and ran back to our room and filled the potbelly stove with coal, and that's what kept us warm. My mother and father worked in the mess hall, I think, for $12 a month. And it was not much money, but enough to buy us warm coats for winter, because we had to go through a winter, very, very cold winter. And I remember putting clothes on top of the bed to keep us warm at night when it was super, super cold. And we had no running water in the room, and of course no toilets. So if we had to go to the toilet, we had to leave the room and walk down to the latrine to use the toilet, even in the middle of the night, even in the snowstorm. So that I remember that. And of course we had to eat whatever they had. And it was the first time I ever ate rutabaga. and I didn't like the rutabagas, but we weren't maltreated, and we did have food, nourishing food. But the saddest thing that happened to our family was the death of my younger brother Kenny. He got spinal meningitis only a few months before we were to leave, when my father got the job in Minneapolis, and he died there. It was the saddest day of my mother's life and my life. I remember the funeral. The casket was covered with crepe paper flowers because there were no real flowers. The women from the church made beautiful colored paper flowers and put them on top of the casket. I remember that. But leaving Kenny behind was just a very sad situation. And my mother had his ashes brought with her. So when my father died years later back in California, she buried his ashes with my father. So that gave her some sense of relief. But, you know, the worst thing that happened to me, not only the death of my brother, who would now be almost 90, because I'm 91 and he was 18 months younger than me, was the loss of self-esteem. You don't realize that going to jail does something to your spirit. It makes you feel less than the next person. Even though I know that I didn't do anything wrong, even though the government did give reparations afterwards to all the persons who survived the camp, still it just does something to your spirit. So even now today, even though I know I'm just as good as anybody else, I still have that feeling of loss of self-esteem. It just makes you feel kind of a little bit less than somebody else.
I'm Lotta Murty with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you recently joined us for today's show and want to listen to the entire broadcast, you can. It's available on our website at www.kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you will find this show and many others to choose from. Today, I am talking with Margaret Nakamura Cooper, a Japanese-American resident of Santa Maria, California, about her experiences before, during, and after internment during World War II. So, Margaret, what brought you to the Central Coast?
Well, actually, it was by accident. You see, my husband and I were artists at Disney Studios in Burbank, California. And my husband was an animator, and we both worked on Sleeping Beauty. But it was not as steady work as one might want when you had a family, and we were starting a family. So my husband reached into his background, and since he had a teaching credential from San Jose State, we both had teaching credentials, he decided it was time to pull that out and become a teacher. So he made a career change, and that's what brought us to Santa Maria. He was driving north to the Bay Area, and on the way, he saw this good-looking school in Santa Maria, and he stopped at a phone booth and made a call, and Mr. Graham answered the phone. He was a principal because his secretary was out to lunch, and my husband said, I'm looking for an art job as an art teacher. I have a secondary teaching credential, And Mr. Graham said, come right over. He says, I think I have a place for you. So as it turned out, this was July, and in September he had to have an art teacher. So it was a shoo-in, and Fred got the job. And we got a place to live in the teacherage right across the street from the school. So that was also a very fortunate happening. So that's what brought us to Santa Maria.
And what year was that?
That was 1963. And my husband said, we're only going to stay here a year because this is just such a small, nothing town. But as fate would have it, this was around the hippie age, and he said, well, you know, maybe we'll stay a few years longer because the Bay Area, where we wanted to end up, was getting well known as a place for marijuana and very, very crazy living with long hair and hippies wandering around. So he said, we'll stay here for a while where it's safe for our three kids. So that we stayed, and of course we've been here ever since. My sons went to local schools. They all three went to Cal Poly. All three became engineers, and when all three of your sons are retired, then you know you're old.
So could you talk specifically about your experience as a Japanese-American woman on the Central Coast?
Well, I would say that people in the Central Coast have been very kind to me. And I've been, you know, lucky to have a steady job, many good friends, and I've joined many local institutions, and I feel part of the community. So I know I shouldn't feel what I did before, feeling second class, even though occasionally that feeling does pop up. On the whole, I would say the people in the community have been very kind to me.
How do people on the Central Coast react or respond when you tell them you were interned during World War II?
Well, some of them are just incredulous because I went to have my hair cut the other day, and the girl said, I told her about my going to a reunion at Heart Mountain, and she never knew that this thing ever happened. So I have made it a point to, when people ask me to speak about this, I always say yes, because I think it's important that people know about the history of our country. And even though there are things that are not so great, it's an opportunity to say to ourselves that we will never let this happen again.
And you organized a flag signing as well.
Yes. There's a Superior Court Judge Johnny Gogo of Santa Clara has taken around an American flag with 48 stars and had people sign who were interned during World War II. And it started out with one flag that he took around locally, but then it's turned out now that he has six flags with signatures of all the people who were interned. And of course, now all the people that were interned are dying out. And I'm probably one of the few people that remember the experience. And soon people of my age will be gone, and there will be nobody to talk about it, nobody who really experienced it.
So other than making sure younger generations remember the internment of Japanese Americans and don't let it happen again, what else do you hope younger generations or anyone on the Central Coast will learn from the history of Japanese American internment?
I hope they learn that the color of your skin has nothing to do with your American Americanism. I think that whether you're black or brown or of Asian descent like I am, there should be no difference in our devotion to our country. We're all Americans, and we should be treated as such. And I think that more and more people are beginning to realize this. And we are known throughout the world as a democracy of people who treat each other with dignity. And I hope, even though we do have exceptions, I hope that we continue to try to make ourselves better.
Any other final statements or thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with about your experiences?
Well, I would like to say that when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. And I think I've tried to make lemonade out of my life because I feel that my life has, on the whole, been a bit positive. And even though I've had this couple of years of disaster, I would call it, I feel that in the end, I feel that I've lived a very productive life.
Thank you, Margaret. I'm so grateful that our guest, Margaret Nakamura Cooper, could join me today. Margaret is a Japanese-American resident of Santa Maria. We've been talking about what it was like for her to be interned both in Santa Anita and also Heart Mountain, Wyoming in 1942, from 1942 to 1943 during World War II. We also discussed what brought her to Santa Maria 20 years later, around 1963, where she never thought she would still be today, but she's still on the Central Coast enjoying life here. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. I am Lotta Murty. Thank you for joining us today.